You can believe this or not. Today, after a nice breakfast, it was kind of brunch time, I went in to lie down and get a little sleep, and I told May when I got up at 1:30, I didn't want to get out of bed. I didn't want to get up and come here. And it reminded me of a wonderful story. A woman went upstairs to awaken her son to go to school, and he started to cry. He said, "I don't want to go to school. I hate school. They call me names." She said, "You get up and get out of bed. I'll go down and fix your breakfast, and then I'll come up and see you." 10 minutes later, she came up. She said, "It's time to get up and get out of bed." And he started to sob. He pulled the covers over his head. He said, "I don't want to go to school. They hate me there. They throw stones at me." She said, "I'll give you two good reasons why you ought to get out of bed. Number one, you're 34 years old. Number two, you're the principal of the place." Well, anyway. But anyway, I have a few notes on the board here because I no longer write while I'm talking. And so we had this put up here for today's talk. It's on self-esteem. What do you think of yourself? Would any of you even think of showing one day of your life, just one, on a screen up here for the rest of us to see? 24 hours. Everything that came out of your mouth, every thought that went through your head, even thoughts about your husband or wife, your parents, your best friend. God, he looks cheesy today, you know. Whatever goes on in here, and whatever you did during the day. And I have often said, and I mean this, I would not want even one individual to see my best day. And if you think seriously about it, I don't think you would either. Does that mean we're the most awful, evil people on earth? No, it doesn't. It just means that we are what we are, damaged human beings. And my friends, the greatest saints always looked on themselves as the greatest of sinners. Let's see what contributes all through a lifetime to one's low esteem of self and how that affects your life. The influences that can cause a lot of self-esteem, most of it, are internal, the things that I have said that I wish I could unsay, the things that I have done that I wish I could undo, and all the circumstances that I've brought on myself. The circumstances and the people outside of me, people who imposed a poor self-worth on me. And then we will hit what has brought us here together, what addiction does to us. I wonder how many youngsters, for some perverted reason, have been harmed most by their parents, scolded for not getting all A's when they were unable to get them. You're dumb. You're fat. Oh, how lazy can you get? Have any of you ever heard the phrase, "You'll never amount to anything"? Isn't that a wonderful way and a wonderful set of values to be raised on? I wonder how many have been utterly deprived of any education, from parental education, about the values and the religious truths on which most of us were raised. I remember speaking to a former POW who was on the faculty at the Naval Academy, and he said to me, he had been tortured for 6 years, I had just done a film on values, and it was criticized by a friend of mine. He said, "Let me tell you something, Father. When you are reduced to owning nothing but 50% of your underwear, you'd better have a grab bag of values to dip into and cling to when everything around you is going crazy. Even youngsters, even rebellious teenagers, wordlessly, they don't have to say this, but there's something in the human heart that almost demands that there is something that I can look to for protection, some set of truths that will never change." And a lot of children are deprived of that. The insecurity of not fitting in. Columbine, those poor kids that were the result of bullying, ended up taking lives and then their own. Isn't that tragic for youngsters to hit that point in your life? It's almost unbelievable. To be, you know, some clown once said, the teen years, the good old days. Ladies and gentlemen, the good old days were rotten unless you were born and raised on another planet. As far as religion is concerned, a priest once asked the kid, he said, "What are you, son?" And the boy said, "I'm a Catholic." He said, "Do you go to Mass?" The kid said, "I'm no fanatic." And I wonder, in our very early years, you know what I believe, and I believe it most strongly, peer pressure in certain areas of life or certain ages in one's life is much stronger than the sexual urge. We do anything to fit in. Many youngsters acquire a garbage language that really is shocking. I'm no prude. But when I hear filth out of the mouth of an 8-year-old, that does something to me. I must fit in. I must be like my buddies for them to accept me. Drugs, smoking, lying, stealing, and even become a bully oneself in order to fit in with the in crowd. And this begins, as most of you who are parents know, in what they call middle school now. These are hardly babies out of infancy. And now they are acquiring the ways of adults. Clothing. You know, it's a wonderful thing to hear youngsters say, "I want to be individual." And they wear clothing that if their mothers brought it home from shopping and gave it to them to wear, they wouldn't. But since their buddies do such things, so do they. They think they're being individual and free and exerting their humanity. Those things are a uniform they wouldn't get caught dead not wearing. They think they're being individual, and they're rushing to conform, rushing to do it. And that's what gets them into trouble. Once you start smoking, you hide. You don't want your mother and father to know you're smoking. And when you get into drugs, it's even worse. You hide is right. And so the little kids start changing their behavior, and the parents wonder what in the name of God's happened to them. They don't want to be around their parents. They want to be with their buddies. They want to try these new things to shove into their bodies. Now, when you get on drugs, you have to do a lot of stealing in order to stay in drugs because no kid has the money to do it. You change yourself entirely. And now we come to addiction to drugs. Ladies and gentlemen, we all know addiction does things to us that we would never choose with a rational mind. Young women peddle, if they're attractive, the one thing they have in order to get boys to give them drugs. Many turn to prostitution without a thought. When your body demands what it cannot exist without, you will do what it takes to get them. whether the addiction is to drugs or alcohol or both or either or. You become a thief, a liar. You look like you're going somewhere to attend a skunk squirting contest. This grunge-looking business. School dropouts. I was just talking to a young woman, a real favorite of mine, because of the turnabout that she made some time ago. Her parents are so thrilled with this girl, but she had to drop out of school. She's going to pick it up again now that she's sober. It's awfully hard to hold a job if a youngster today doesn't like what he's doing and just walks out, quits. It's a terrible life. And I have always said, you know what I think brings some youngsters to treatment? They can't stand themselves. The greatest grace that God Almighty can give any addict, alcoholic or drug addict, is the grace to look into a mirror and experience an undeniable, overwhelming desire to vomit because you just can't stand what you're looking at. What have I become? I've asked several youngsters who have given me the same answer. I have had enough of living this way. They tell the story of a young fellow. He had a mohawk, went from here to the base of the neck. And down that mohawk strip of hair were 9 pointed, gelled towers of hair, each one a different color. The rest of his entire head was tattooed, and wherever metal could hang, it was there. And a man got on the bus, sat opposite him, and he couldn't take his eyes off him. He just kept staring at him. And finally the boy said, "Mister, why are you staring at me? When you were young, didn't you ever do anything stupid?" And the guy said, "Well, yes." He said, "I was in the Navy when I was a youngster." And he said, "Once our ship docked in Singapore," and he said, "a bunch of my shipmates and I took shore leave. And," he said, "I'm told I got horribly drunk and married a parrot. And I just thought maybe you might be my son." That's what he thought. Anyway, let's come into adulthood. You know, I think that physical attraction is the thing that God uses to trap people into marriage. Because after a while, when the romance kind of thins out, you have different situations in different homes. I would like to tell you a story that was told to me by a patient in a treatment center. He said, "This is my father's favorite story, and I've heard it thousands of times. A young fellow was in love with 2 women. One was a ravishing beauty, but a real airhead. Nothing. Zero. The other was as homely as a pigsty in midwinter, but she had a glorious singing voice. She sang, there were standing ovations." And he's thinking and pondering, who should I ask to marry me if indeed either one would have me? And so he prayed over it and thought about it, and his head ruled his heart. He said, "I'll ask the homely girl, because if I ask this beautiful young woman after 10 minutes of married life, what do we talk about for the rest of our lives?" So he married the homely girl. It's now the morning after the wedding, and they're at the breakfast table having a cup of coffee. Now, when he wakes up, he wakes up. It takes her about an hour and a half to come to. So he's sitting there drinking his coffee, staring at her. He's thinking, this dear soul was ugly in her wedding gown, but this is ridiculous. And then it struck him, what have I done to myself? And after about 10 minutes, he couldn't take it anymore. He looked at her and said, for God's sake, sing! But anyways, when a lot of the huggy-poo, kissy-poo begins to wear slim, many an abusive husband will start the put-downs, the emotional battering. And that's what it gets down to, battering, insulting. The wife is left alone a lot. It's her business to raise the children, keep a clean home, and handle all the duties and so on. But she's alone. That isn't what she got married for. And so, when you are starved for affection, you look for it. And then things happen that you never dreamed would happen to you. An affair or two. And then, since you don't have a whole lot of spending money of your home, if you're from the lower blue-collar type family, you begin to steal a bit from your husband. You begin to lie a bit about why you've been out during the day. You borrow from anyone you can borrow from till they hate to see you come around. You put yourself in debt. You are unable to care for the kids the way you thought you should. You're unable to care for the home, and that brings on more abuse. The fights between parents in front of children, there can't be any thought behind that. There can't be any mature adult thought behind it. You want to have your differences happen, but do you know what that does to little 3-year-olds and 10-year-olds? And when a divorce happens, the kids, somehow, most kids feel it's my fault. If I had been a better son or a daughter, this wouldn't have happened. And in some cases, the parents allow them to believe that. Many women are declared unfit mothers. What a kick in the face that must be. I know of a couple when the wife, in one of her own final drunks, said to her husband, who was about to leave, please don't leave, I think I'm going to die. He said, go ahead and die. We'd be better off without you. What kind of self-worth does such a woman have? Zero. Zero. The men who become addicted, they're away from home a lot. Infidelity is almost a way of life. And then this. When he's hung over and can't get to work, he gets the wife to lie for him. Have you any idea at all, any idea, what it means to do damage to another conscience? Lying is a prostitution of the soul. And to force someone to lie for you. He misses all of the children's activities, games, school projects, helping them with their lessons. Well, that's not my business. Yes, it is! That's what fathers are for. That's what mothers are for. Well, then the elderly. I can tell you a little bit about that. It's tough. They even have courses in the military and I think in industry preparing people, preparing them for retirement. It's a tough life to live. There was an old Jewish immigrant, came over here from Russia at the age of 11, worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, became a multimillionaire in the garment district. He retired. Went to Florida, put up a castle on the beach, and became colossally bored and depressed. Depression usually, in many cases anyway, follows boredom. And another old Jewish fellow come up to him one day. He used to just go down to the shore and watch the tide come in and go out. And he got telling his newfound friend that he was so bored and so horribly depressed. And the other old Jewish fellow said, "Well, we found out here you got to have a hobby." He said, "A hobby?" "Yeah," he said, "you don't got a hobby, you go crazy." "Well," he said, "you got a hobby?" And the guy says, "Certainly." He said, "What do?" He said, "I raise bees." "You raise bees?" "Yeah, every Monday I drive into Miami, I buy a big bucket of bees, I bring them home, throw them in the closet." He said, "You throw them in the closet, they die." He said, "I know, but what the hell, it's a hobby." When you're in industry, when you're in the military, when you're in anything, you have a mission, a purpose. This is what I'm here for, this is what I do, this is what I get paid to do. That's no longer there. There is no mission. There is no purpose. Then medication. I take 10 pills every day. I am a walking pharmacy. Going to bed at night, because of a lot of the medications that I take for the eyes, the teeth, the ears, the nose, the belly. Going to bed at night begins with a removal of parts. Come on. He's come out. He's come out. Got out over one night, there's more meal in the dresser than in the bed. There are times in your old age in which you can and should enjoy things. And don't mistake me, I do. I have a completely happy life. But with the aches and the pains and the... I can't walk from here to there. My balance is shot and will be till I die. Well, I can accept that. I take that. That's what is. So what? You know, you can always look at somebody, and I see it by the thousands, who are less than my age and worse off. So you just have to prepare for things. You find that most of the names in your address book end with MD, and you see a great deal of them, and you see them very often. But that's the way it is, and you take that. You're hearing... My hearing started to go about 10 years ago. They tell a wonderful story of an old married couple that discovered a brand new restaurant. They were bragging on it to some friends the next day. All the food was indescribably delicious. The service was impeccable. And this went on and on. Finally, his friends said, "Well, what's the name of it? We'd like to go." He said, "What's the name of that red flower with the thorns in the stem?" And his buddy said, "It's a rose." "Oh, yeah. Hey, Rose, what was the name of that restaurant?" This is a short memory. That hearing, a man told an ear doctor, he said, "I suspect my wife is losing her hearing." And the doctor said, "Send her down." He said, "We'll see what we can do. But in the meantime, I want you to use a little experiment that might help me. When she's at one end of the house, you go to the farthest corner of the house and ask her a question. And if you don't get an answer, move closer and closer until you do. And let me know about how far that was. That'll give me some indication of how bad the condition is." So that very evening, she went in the kitchen to get dinner. And he went up the second floor in the front bedroom. "What are you fixing for dinner?" He didn't hear a thing. went to the head of the stairs. What's for dinner? Went down the dining room right next to it. What's for dinner? Then he went out to the kitchen, and into her ear he said, "What are you fixing for dinner?" And she screamed, "For the fourth time, I'm fixing spaghetti." Anyway, there are all kinds of old people's stories, and they are funny. You know, you could go on forever about what causes low self-esteem. The very young, because their bodies are immature and not yet fully coordinated, and the very old, because their bodies are wearing out. Both of those age groups are highly susceptible to addiction. And what often happens among the very old is they are given certain prescriptions, let's say for sleep and so on, and they're on these things, and then they find they've got all kinds of time to drink. And boy, it's almost immediate for many of them. They're young married children come to visit them, and they notice bruises from falls, falling around. They're not overly coordinated. They're very susceptible to, you know, what whiskey or booze of any kind does to the human body, and very quickly they become victims. What does somebody say, let's say, who has spent a very productive life in the business world, finds himself a falling down drunk? Is this what my life is leading me to? How do I get out of this? Well, instead of spending hours talking about what brings it on, the purpose of this talk is, what do we do about it? Embracing completely the 12 principles of living that AA offers its sons and daughters will reverse that thing and bring about what AA itself refers to as a 180-degree change in one's life. You see, let's take a look at addiction briefly in a sentence or two. Addicted people drink or drug because they can't not do it. That's nothing to do with willpower. I've told audiences everywhere, my will is as strong as yours will ever be, give or take a little. I could not handle my intake of alcohol. It was destroying my life. And so it is with anyone addicted. It destroys your life. Because by trying to live two lives with one conscience, we find that's impossible to do without excruciating pain. And you can only live with other and self-inflicted pain for so long until it becomes unbearable, and then you find you have to do something about it to make the pain stop. We alienate God. We alienate ourselves, we alienate others. And very often the only solution is more of what causes it. And so we wind up frustrated, we can't do what we were created to do, which basically is to love God, self, and others. We can't do that. We're not free. We do not have freedom of choice. Our behavior is dictated. And so, these 12 principles are meant to stop the intake of alcohol and or drugs and to realign these three relationships that have been all but wiped out. To love means to function for the good of another. And very often we have to climb over negative emotions to do it. It's the member of AA who goes on a 12-step call and tries to get a drunk into treatment, and the guy is cursing him while he does it. Bounces off. They know how to take those things now. But this is a way of life that is not easy. AA, ladies and gentlemen, does not consist in what you snow each other with at meetings. It's what you live in between them from what you've heard at meetings. It is this that will make you look at yourself one day in the same mirror that turned you away and look at yourself openly and honestly and evaluate the way you are living and what you are doing for others, for God, and for yourself. And you can say, in all honesty, I like me now. If you haven't said it, you might. And if you haven't said it, I know you've heard it. My life is different now. I try to do decent things. My life is different now. I don't try to do my boss out of pay, not showing up and reporting in sick. I put in an honest day's work for a day's pay, and I'm proud of that. I don't cheat on my wife. I don't cheat on my husband anymore. I know what the rules are. There's no mystery to any of this. Self-esteem is poor. Reverse it. Why should I never forget the things that lowered my self-esteem? Well, the surest way to humility is through humiliation. And I look at my past, and it gains a great deal of humility that nothing else can bring. It's a great life you and AA have, and you are the chosen, because very few people will change their lives from this to this unless they have a goad pushing them. When you are faced with death or insanity or incarceration, if you are lucky enough to have the good Lord give you the choice and you come running into AA, you are one of the thrice blessed on this earth. Many people go to their graves continually doing and giving in to all of this, and the worst of this is self-hatred. God Almighty never created us to hate ourselves. And He is the God who touches souls through AA. There's a friend of mine, just died, friend of our family. He was important to us for many, many, many reasons. He went through a horrible cancer, a lot of pain, and died a beautiful death. He was a member of AA, and I've heard him speak many times. And he always concluded his talks by reciting a poem that is one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. And in his memory, I would like to read it to you. It is called "The Touch of the Master's Hand." The author is Myra Brooks Welch. "'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, but held it up with a smile. "'What am I bidding, good folks?' he cried. "'Who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar, then. Two, only two. $2, and who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three, but no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. Then, wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening the loose strings, he played a melody pure and sweet as a caroling angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, "What am I bid for the old violin?" And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, and who'll make it two? $2,000, and who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, and going and gone, said he. The people cheered, but some of them cried, "We do not quite understand what changed its worth." Swift came the reply, "The touch of a master's hand." And many a man with life out of tune and battered and scarred with sin is auctioned cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He is going once and going twice and going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that's wrought by the touch. Of the master's hand. It's for you, Jamie. Thank you. Thank you.